right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 7 of Agitated Podcast. This is Caitlin, and we've got the full team here to do our opening up, and let's just jump right into it. What's agitating you guys right now?
So I'm sure by now you all have seen, like, groups of progressives running down the street licking Ben and Jerry's, praising them like they're going to save us all, right? But, like, I'm going to preface this by saying, like, stop praising companies for doing mediocre shit, right? Anything they do is self-serving and half-assed. Corporations wielding power for their own good or any function of fucking capitalism is not going to save us. So, last month, Ben and Jerry's announced it would no longer sell its products in Jewish settlements built on occupied Palestinian land in the West Bank and East Jerusalem.
Amazing!
But remember, folks, wow. Like, all of Israel is fucking occupied territory. And I, like, dare to even remind you that, like, the U.S. is occupied territory. Mm-hmm. So, like, okay, so
nobody gets ice cream.
Further, the company is going to continue selling ice cream in Israel, quote unquote, proper. And they also manufacture their product with an Israeli company that will continue to do so through, like, the end of 2020 when the contract expires. So it's like, wait 2020? A second. You're not actually 22. Yeah.
Okay.
2022. Sorry. What did I say? Bajillion years further. But anyway, like, you're not even doing anything proactively anyway. You're letting your contract lapse. You know, like, that's, first of all, that's not taking a stand. Also, like, refusing to, like, sell in the occupied territories, what is somebody going to do? Like, you know, the Israelis living in these occupied territories are going to leave and go two blocks to a supermarket where they can buy it. Like, they're not losing any money. They're not making any statement with this. And also, like, not to be fooled, right? Like, this is not a part of the boycott, divest, and sanction movement, right? This movement seeks to withhold all financial support of all Israeli products because virtually all Israeli companies are complicit to some degree in Israeli's system of occupation and apartheid and ongoing genocide of the Palestinian people. Like, duh. So they're getting supposed flack and, like, taking a big stand, right?
Right-wingers, like, are never going to eat Ben & Jerry's again. Because I bet you they already loved all of Ben & Jerry's stands from before. So,
it's like, yeah.
Who does this even affect?
I do want to say that, like, you are 100% correct, Millie. But there's also, like, I think we should be allowed to kind of enjoy the
No enjoyment here. Right-wing
and, like,
Ben
official-
& Jerry's, the co-founders. They are like, this is what they're going around touting. They're like, hey, we're proud Jews and we support the Israel, you know, the state of Israel. We just don't support this. And so, like, you cannot support the state of Israel and not support their occupation.
I didn't realize they were explicit about supporting the state of Israel. They say that?
Yeah, I mean, the official Israel Twitter account went after them. They made I can't find it. They made a really cringy joke, which, you know, the fact that there is a state with an official account that does, like, cute little woo-woo. We've talked about some of the shit this account has pulled in the past.
But we should link to this account
they tried to crack
so people
a joke
can
about
look at
how
it.
Ben and Jerry's sucks. There's no other state, legitimate or illegitimate, in this fucking planet who has an official account that behaves in the way that this account does. So, like, that was funny. Then there were some you know, Israeli folks who, there was one in particular who, like, took a picture of his full pints of Ben and Jerry's in the garbage. So he just, like, bought the ice cream. So I'm not, again, this is not to detract from the most important points that you're making, Millie, but I don't want anyone to feel bad about, like, kind of enjoying.
Well, here's how I feel like this is actually very important and we should be, like, paying very close attention, because since this has happened, Israel has asked 35 U.S. governors to enforce state laws, which make it a crime to support the BDS movement. So despite me, like, clarifying that, no, this actually is not a part of BDS, they have taken the opportunity to crack down on anyone attempting, you know, to...
Right.
And
right.
then, you know, not saying that this just happened either overnight. I think it was, like, starting back in 2015 where these laws were started to be passed. And now I think we're at 35 now. And, you know, that have been passed through bipartisan support.
Right.
And a lot of, I think, a big reason that they're so effective is that these laws prohibit the investments of state pension funds in companies that boycott Israel. So that, you know, that again steers funds in such a very direct way.
It's so interesting on the heels of the conversations we're having about Cuba. The United States is like, we will sanction and embargo the shit out of everybody. But if you tell anyone not to buy a soda stream, we will fucking arrest you.
Yes.
Yeah. No exaggeration. All right. Okay.
So keep boycotting, but do it in a real fucking way.
Also, Ben and Jerry's is... Just so everybody knows, Ben and Jerry's is owned by, like, Unilever, and Ben and Jerry don't own Ben and Jerry's, and they haven't for a really long time. It's a giant international
company. And it was actually the board of the independent company, Ben and Jerry's, that voted for this, and then whatever the megacorp that you just mentioned is, they're very much trying in every way to separate them from, you know, that, and, you know, made very public statements of like, well, we'll see how this actually gets played out. Like, well, we're going to fight it, you know, tooth and nail, of course.
Okay, so corporations are not to be the actors in bringing about social movements or social change.
Da-da-da!
Don't
we're
forget
always
it.
Saying this.
Right. That's a thread.
What's agitating you, Jessica?
Okay, well, speaking of fucking corporations... That's also a theme. What's got me agitated right now is actually the resistance efforts to stop Line 3. I'm going to read you about Line 3 in case we're not totally clear what that is. And this, a lot of this information comes from stopline3.org, which I'll put in the show notes. So Line 3 is a proposed pipeline expansion to bring about 1 million barrels of tar sands per day from Alberta, Canada to Superior, Wisconsin. It was proposed in 2014 by Enbridge, which is the Canadian pipeline company responsible for actually the largest inland oil spill in the U.S. ever. So at least we're in good hands. Enbridge seeks to build a new pipeline corridor through all of these like untouched wetlands and treaty territory and wild rice fields, which is like a very important staple for the people who live there. And it's treaty territory of Anishinaabe people, goes through the Mississippi River headwaters and to the shore of Lake Superior. So it's really long and goes through like hundreds of bodies of water. So we've talked about pipelines before a little bit, but because it begs to be said again, I guess, in case we're not all aware why pipelines are so bad and why there's so much resistance. So first of all pipelines spill, right? We know this, we've seen this 100,000 times. Enbridge, the specific company building this pipeline, averages one spill every 20 days. And that's what's reported, like that's what we see, right? The environmental devastation as a result of the transportation of oil is super extreme. And that's like after it's been extracted from the earth in the most harmful ways. That's just getting it where it needs to go to refine it and sell it. So Line 3 isn't about safe transportation of a necessary product and like infrastructure. It's a super high risk exploitative way for a few people to make a lot of money. And it's about expanding the tar sands industry. And tar sands is like the worst kind of oil. Tar sands create 30% more emissions than conventional oil. So it's just like the worst. Yeah. And so it's really important that we understand that Line 3, like there's so many reasons why this is just horrific, but Line 3 violates the treaty rights of the Anishinaabe people and nations in the path that it's on. So what's happening here is like an obvious and clear treaty violation, which happens in pipeline cases all the time, and what's called regulatory capture, which is when public institutions abandon public interest in order to serve private profits, right? We see it all the time. So what happens is these hedge fund people come in and make a really high risk and quick investment. Like, let's get all this tar sand oil and sell it and we'll make a shitload of money really quick. And we know it'll break and spill and kill people and animals and completely disregard public opinion and environmental considerations and treaty rights. But we don't care at all because this could make us a lot of money real quick. And the Public Utilities Commission is supposed to make decisions like that are consistent with public opinion in theory. And polling shows that 94% of people oppose this pipeline. So there's 94%. Yeah, 94%. So like there's there's no question about how this is just such a blatant, like, it doesn't matter what the people think or need or what will kill lots of things right now. We don't care.
Well, and it's also just so explicit. This week, it just came out, like, the IPCC, you know, the UN-sponsored body that does reports on climate change, just came out with their newest report, which is like, everything is fucked. It's well underway. Like, it's crazy that there are any tar sands projects that are not being just, like, shut down all over the place. And yet they're still just like,
don't these CEOs have children? I don't understand.
Yeah, I don't think they care. I don't know. Yeah, it's bananas. So the other thing to note that, you know, of course, like, we're probably all thinking is that because Enbridge is a corporation enjoying the same constitutional rights that human beings in theory have, but they're also enjoying limited liability. So that means when their inevitable oil spills cause, like, massive harm and death, there's no accountability. There's no system for accountability. It's just an oops. And they move on and do the next one. Mm-hmm. So there's these people that the water protectors who are out there resisting this line being constructed are so badass. Like, it's amazing. These people are putting their bodies on the line to stop this massively destructive thing from happening. And those people are my fucking heroes. And I'll put it in the show notes, but I've been following them on Instagram. There's a couple accounts, but resist line 3 with underscores between each of those. It's a really good account. And they're showcasing what's being done. And they're being faced with hardcore. These people are being
brutalized. I mean, physically brutalized. Hardcore.
Yeah. Super militarized police presence. Like Standing Rock, right? There was like tons of tanks and water cannons and all that. And it's gotten so much worse. Yeah. And so far, over 600 people have been arrested in resistance to this pipeline. 600 people.
Whoa.
Yeah. Like,
it's not talked about anywhere.
Talked about. I mean, Democracy Unlimited is where I like got some information Democracy and stuff. Now. And you know, like, there's right. the like, sorry, Democracy Now is where I got all this information. No, so you know, they're just like your like lefty media, but like I haven't seen this anywhere except from the people who are there doing it. And I'm just super inspired, and that's the part that's agitating me right now is just like there's such artful, creative, badass people like locking themselves to tractors and laying in ditches when they're trying to lay the pipeline and parking their cars in the way of the equipment, and like so many ways people are resisting. And you know, we know this works. Like, we've talked about that on the show. It's impactful and it actually does stop the construction of pipelines. So these water protectors are calling for others to join them by coming out to the pipeline, by studying and understanding what's going on, talking about this and donating. So you should go to stopline3.org to learn more about what they're asking us to do and follow some accounts on social media. Lakota Law, Resist Line 3, I'll put that in the show notes. So yeah, it's really important.
But and just to Thanks, keep Jessica. To keep talking about this and sharing resources, because it's so undercovered and so many people are putting their lives on the line.
Yeah. I don't know. To me, it just feels like the most direct work it's just like such a clear impact. These people can stop this massively devastating thing from happening, you know, and not that they won't move on to the next one, but it still really matters. Like they have truly exhausted resources sometimes to the point where they've stopped.
Well, and also, I mean, I did see again this week with the new climate report coming out, you know, a lot of people who are not engaged particularly politically, you know, maybe they donate to causes or candidates, you know, come election time, asking, you know, like, wait a minute, what can we do about this? And stopping these pipeline projects are, you know, it's directly relevant. It is directly a way to slow down climate catastrophe, to stop fossil fuel production. That's, you know, I mean, obviously that should be done at the political policy level. But until that point, direct action at the point of that extraction and harm is probably, like you said, our most strategic way to slow things down. And so, you know, more of us who have not done things like that before are going to need to step up if we care at all. And there's still, I mean, even though this report was devastating, it also said, you know, there's still a little bit of room to slow this down. If we drastically cut and ultimately stop, you know, fossil fuel emissions, that is the cause of climate change. So any of us who care about it, that's the place that we should be intervening.
And if you yourself can't go, there are many, many ways to obviously support the efforts that are happening there, but also to reach into your community and see if there are folks able to go and, you know, financially support that journey. Because they need more bodies, and that's what they're asking for.
And also all of these people who are being arrested, you know, the laws have changed in Standing Rock to make it to make penalties, you know, higher. And that is continuing on. You know, our government has also used what happened on January 6th as an excuse to crack down on people who are protesting against climate change. And so, you know, again, if you can't go, you can support people who are on, you know, while they're resisting and then also afterwards, because these, you know, people are willing, are risking potentially, you know, their lives, not yet necessarily with death, but I mean, the jail sentences are not small.
Yeah. What was it? Those two women who were with like the Catholic workers or whatever. Mm-hmm. And their sentences were like 15 years or something. It was really, really
for sabotage of the pipeline at Standing Rock. Yeah. Which is exactly what we need to be doing, though, right? I mean, if this is like an existential crisis, life or death for, you know, millions of people and species, then absolutely it is worth it to do that kind of risk. But we have to be real about like what it is, and we have to support people. And the only way that we're going to get that to shift is if there's massive public support for people doing civil disobedience. That is what is needed for civil disobedience to be effective. So even if that doesn't feel like something that you personally can put your body into, you can make a very big difference in whether this is an effective tactic or not.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for saying that. So that's agitating as fuck.
Well, thanks, you guys. Should we move to our main topic and pass it over to Shelley, who's going to start us off?
All right. You're a resident, very on Twitter co-host. I want to kind of do like a post-mortem on this March for Medicare for All that took place on July 24th, because I think there is just a lot. I mean, people aren't really talking about it anymore. By the time this podcast comes out, they will be talking about it even less. But it's important because it drew a lot of lines, I think, and just kind of speaks to the current state of the left, both on Twitter and now also off. I think it is a lesson in kind of the differences between, you know, the tension between national level and local level organizing, and just kind of like two sides that I think pretty much, I think all four of us on this show are not, you know, in either camp fully. But I think it's, you know, it's important to talk about kind of, so it basically comes down to a tension that originally sprang out of the Force the Vote movement, which if folks don't know what that is, it was a strategy that, you know, some will attribute to like 2019 DSA single-payer organizing literature as part of like a larger host of tactics to get Medicare for All. And Jimmy Dore, who has a podcast, and he kind of, you know, started talking about this strategy as like the only way. And there was just kind of like a really diehard movement that formed around that. But Force the Vote was basically the squad withholding their speakership vote for Nancy Pelosi in exchange for bringing Medicare for All to the floor to find out who's for it and who's against it and get everyone on record. I mean, it wasn't ever going to like get us Medicare for All, but it was supposed to be like an exposure.
It was like a pressure tactic really, that to try and push on them to exercise their power Can I just say a couple things about it? I mean,
sure.
I do think that it was, like, Jimmy Dore was talking about it in terms of Medicare for all, but part of the, and that was what it was directly about. But I think that it would, we would be in a really different place if we had started off this year with members of Congress with threatening to withhold support for Pelosi over anything. But Medicare for mm-hmm. all arguably was a very strategic demand because of two things. One, you know, we know that Americans want it and we know how critical it is for Americans. And we've talked on the show before about my, you know, my personal opinion that it's the policy solution that would really boost things and the left movement much more than probably anything else in an immediate way. But also, it would just show an act of force on the part of progressives in Congress that, you know, they have been unwilling to show and have kind of been biding, no pun intended, their time on supposedly when that will happen. And, like, we haven't seen any cause, you know, it hasn't come up yet. They haven't exercised power in any way or withheld power in any way from the majority block of the Democratic Party. And if they did, they could actually stop things. And if we look at, like, for example, the Tea Party and how much control they've been able to exercise over the direction of the Republican Party when they refused the members that were in Congress to go along with the rest of the party and basically make demands. And then the other last piece is that we do have this problem where people increasingly are willing to sign on to the Medicare for All bill in Congress, but then still take contributions from the pharmaceutical industry or giant insurance corporations. And so it's like they'll say that they'll do it for votes, but then they're not actually willing to challenge the industry that is the reason why we don't have Medicare for All. And so forcing a vote, a floor vote, even though it would not win, would help flesh out, like, who's on what side, which is pretty critical if you have a strategy for we need to elect people to Congress who support this policy. Well, you need to know who those people really are. And if they're lying to you and saying who they are, you need to actually flesh that out. So you know, I mean, even AOC, basically, when she was first elected, you know, talked about a strategy like this for Medicare for All. And that's what people were saying is like, OK, now's the time. This is such a good time. We're in a pandemic. You can leverage this against Pelosi. You have, you know, these critical votes that the party is going to need to pass things, you know, flex your power. And they refused.
Yeah. And I do agree with that. I'm not sure that bringing it to a vote that was definitely not going to pass is going to expose the people who, if it were actually mm-hmm. at a point mm-hmm. where it could pass, I think that there could still be a lot of symbolic support that people could get away with in that scenario.
But it also would raise the issue into a national discourse that's right. not happening right now, too. So right. it would move us forward rather than the place where we are now, where there's nothing. I mean, I will. This is Caitlin. And, like, I definitely think that they should have exercised the force to vote. I think that was a good policy a good strategy. And, you know, it's not like it was foolproof. It's not like it would have got us everything. But right now, I think the question is reasonable of, like, okay, well, then if that's not your strategy, then what is your strategy to move Medicare for All right. forward? Where mm-hmm. is it?
Yeah. And and I agree with all of that. There was also, you know, when you have a very loud, aggressive white guy mm-hmm. who is using kind of language, you know, he's the face of this. He kind of appointed himself and was, like, very okay with that role. You know, a lot of people were kind of uncomfortable. Like, I might agree with this tactic, but this energy is fucking weird. And I don't see how it is strategic to just, like, constantly, it's not, you know, it's like putting pressure and just, like, bashing the living shit out of people are two different things. And it just kind of created this, like, culture that was, I was like, some of this stuff is kind of icky. Some of this stuff feels like people are just having a good time, just, you know, being really, like, nasty and misogynist and, like, just, I don't know. It got weird. And I think that, you know, that's what happens when certain people, you know, become the face of things. We've been through this, as, you know, in our right. own, like,
well, and to be clear, though, I mean, it just started, and fair, it did just start with him, Jimmy Dore, talking about it on his own show. And then also Justin Jackson talking about it on Twitter to AOC. And then mm-hmm. AOC just getting so defensive that it sort of, like, yeah. continued the whole thing. So there was nobody who was like, let's make a plan to do this and let's have Jimmy Dore be the face of it. He was just sort of like, right. this is where I'm at. I need Medicare for all. And this is my perspective. And, you know, in yeah. terms of the style of his show and whatnot, I mean, I actually appreciate the leadership he's shown on this when nobody else was willing to. But at the same time, you know, I don't tend to listen to his show because it doesn't really put me in a good space to be motivated. It just makes me pissed and sad.
Right. And I, you know, I thought force the vote was fine. I don't think it's the only, you know, way or tactic or the one thing that everybody, you know, in the world should say is the make or break of everything. But I do agree, and I agreed with it at the time, but I also felt uncomfortable, you know, with some of the alignments that I had to make. And I know everyone was like, oh, he's just, you know, oh, it's a podcaster, you're triggered by a podcaster. But it wasn't, you know, there are a lot of people were like, this is not the energy that I want to sign on to, even if I agree with the tactics. So that's one thing. So now it was these folks who kind of, you know, then put their energy into direct action. Good next step. Makes a lot of sense. So organizing a national march to bring attention to the need for Medicare for All. And, you know, I was on board with it, even though there's still, like, people involved that I'm like, I was totally on board with it. But then, you know, I think a lot of the national level organizers were very inexperienced. And so some things started to happen. Okay, and I should also say that the force the vote is what initially kind of created this tension between, like, the DSA, we have to get more progressives in Congress, and we have to be nicer to the squad, which, you know, I can see the problems with that, too. But that's where that tension started. And then the March for Medicare for All.
Wait, real quick, Shelley, I do think we should acknowledge, too, that there also is a different, like, none of the organizational leaders who have been working on Medicare for All were in support of the force the vote tactic either. So, like, the
right.
the national nurses or some of the you know, Medicare for All coalition groups that, you know, really the nurses are largely behind, but they're at this point more than just the nurses, were supportive of that. And you know, and it's because they're working on an inside strategy in Congress, and they have, you know, these congressional members that they've gotten to sign on, and they're trying to move a bill forward, and they have an inside strategy. And it did not come in a sort of, like, inside outside, you do this part, we'll do this part, sort of, like, collaborative way. It came as a spark from a, like, you know, populist grassroots, just, like, the people. And then the establishment, and I use that, like, not necessarily in a negative way, but the folks who have established themselves as the official advocates for Medicare for All were not on board with that. And I think that's relevant, too.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. So now we're at the point where this march is being organized with a lot of the same folks. And this is a lot different than the force the vote, because instead of being just this kind of national online thing, this, you know, there's these marches being organized in cities and towns all across the country. I think in the end there were 56 different marches. And I think everybody was, like, pretty cool with it. I think there were some, you know, some of the people who are biased against that group were, like, keeping an eye on it, but nobody had anything bad to say other than, like, you know, the lack of labor support from the beginning that was never there. And that, you know, there's maybe, who knows all the reasons.
Well, but that comes into play what Caitlin had said a little bit earlier, right, about, like, they already have their own negotiations that they've, like, put so much work into. You know what I mean?
Right.
Okay.
Well, and also, though, just to say, we did talk about this on a previous, I had it as a previous agitation, how labor, like, in New York State is who sunk the Medicare for All bill there. So getting labor on board is like a little bit easier said than done. It's like, obviously we need that to be successful, but at the same time, many labor unions have allowed themselves to be leveraged against Medicare for All in a very short-sighted way. And right. So if you can't get labor involved, that doesn't necessarily mean you're doing shitty organizing. Maybe labor's being shitty too.
So as things are moving along and these marches are being coming to fruition and crystallizing in all these different places, it was, you know, looking great. Then some of the weaknesses started to become clear. So one thing that happened was there was a march in Muncie, Indiana. And I believe that it was basically, so there are, you know, people in like the alt-right who have, who want to infiltrate the left. Like they're, you know, they're having full-on discussions in their little like 4chan spaces about how to do that. And this Matthew Heimbach, who is a co-founder of the Traditionalist Workers Party, fucking neo-Nazi, that is what he is. And he also has a history of trying to befriend the left. So when people are saying, like, you know, red-brown alliance isn't real, you know, I really hope that they're, you know, just being ignorant, because there is active efforts from the right. And then there's some ignorant, kind of naive people on the left who are like, oh, anyway. So he's had some history of actually like doing things and, you know, becoming friends with local Democratic Party folks and all kinds of stuff. So somehow he gets submitted, a neo-Nazi gets submitted as a speaker to this Muncie event. And they just had this like standard graphic or whatever. And, you know, the national social media accounts of this march were posting it. And people who have been organizing for a long time and understand the alt-right and how they work immediately recognize this guy. And they're like, what are you doing? This guy is a neo-Nazi. How did this happen? And then, you know, the reaction, so they, you know, immediately take it down. But the reaction from the national organizers was very childish, and it's hard now. I wish I'd gotten screenshots, because I didn't. This account, the Twitter account specifically, deletes all the stuff that they do that is bad. So you, like, I, you know,
the Twitter account for the national
march from So some people were like really good faith critiquing them, like, listen, you know, your OPSEC is like, this is bad. And their response was just very childish, even though they, you know, they just never really took responsibility for that, and where they were like, oh, we just got trolled. But it's like, these are really, really, really important. If this is going to be your like issue that you're trying to bring everybody together on, it's more important than ever that we keep out neo-Nazis. Like,
well, and, you know, also, just to be clear, I think, you know, because this is an issue now that we've seen that Republican voters poll support for Medicare for All. So it's like, I think there's a lot of people who see the potential to bring working class people who maybe identify as Republican in their politics into an issue that is a progressive issue and potentially build an alliance. And like, that's a good idea. We support that. But you don't do that by going to extremists on the right and saying, here, have a platform for your, you know, white supremacist agenda too.
Like, right. And these people are not there because they want Medicare for All. They're there to undermine what's happening and destroy it. They're smart. They're very smart people. And I think a lot of folks really underestimate, you know, how well they organize and how easily they can, you know.
Maybe that's because they're used to us and our bad organizing on the left. And they were like, we would never conspire so effectively.
Right. Yeah, it's true.
Shit.
So that happens. The response is terrible. And, you know, as somebody who has never, you know, at any point during any of these kind of feuds and tensions has ever been squarely in one camp or the other, and I can hear both sides and I, you know, all of that, it did sour me. But I was like, well, maybe even though they kind of acted a little bit silly on their account, maybe they learned from it. And then this the LA march, it was like a couple of days before the actual march. So this was like, you know, there's one thing to announce a speaker months before and then people can like talk about that a bit. This happened at the very 11th hour that the LA march, which, and this is also like when we're talking about national versus local, like the LA march had really great people. One, Daniel Lee, who was a previous guest, Dr. Daniel Lee, he, you know, he was a speaker. He's been really involved in, you know, the California statewide campaign for single payer. There was a lot of really, really hard people who have been putting in the work. And in California in particular, we, you know, this is, we support Medicare for All on the national level, but we also have a pretty, you know, relatively robust single payer campaign going on in our state as well. So that's another strategy, right? State by state.
Which, quick aside, has been shut down by the Democratic Party. Never going to miss an opportunity to point that out.
Yeah.
Democrats that, in the legislature in California threw it in committee, which is why we haven't been able to move it forward, even though supposedly our governor was going to, you know, not veto it, which is what has happened in the past when there has been a Republican governor. Talk about people who know how to scheme and work it.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. And there's a YouTube show called The Convo Couch, and it's this guy, Craig Jardula, who goes by the name Pasta, so we'll refer to him as Pasta, and then Fiorella Isabel. So I know that Fiorella, you know, a few years ago had kind of more coherent politics that weren't like connected to any kind of like media grift, right? So a lot of times you see people get a show and then they start to kind of change because they're like tapping into some kind of like rage or energy and they're like, oh, I'm getting clicks for this, so I'm going to start being, you know, that's what my suspicion is of what happened with her. But they have this show that, you know, they have pushed Stop the Steal, right? Like, these are people who lent...
Explain what Stop the Steal is in case anybody doesn't know, just real quick.
Stop the Steal was basically, you know, the kind of movement behind what happened on January 6th, the people who believed that Donald Trump actually won the election, that it was rigged, and, you know...
Yeah.
Was very, very little evidence of that being true. We see a lot of the worst stuff that happens is in the Democratic primaries, right? Like, other than that, you know.
Well, and
like,
the logic of it is because the Democratic Party was suspect in a number of places during the Democratic primary, therefore obviously Biden must have stolen the election, because like Trump's saying it, and therefore, and why would you believe Biden? Because his party had shenanigans during the primary, which like never involved like voter fraud shenanigans.
Yeah, it's a totally different animal. Not to mention, if we want to get real about this, the Democratic Party doesn't really give that much of a shit, right? Like, if Trump had been reelected, they'd be like, oh, we have this, you know, we can raise.
We know what to do in this situation.
Exactly. Yep. It, either way, they win, right? So they're not going to, like, go out of their, you know, it's just, it's their, anyway. So they were pushing that, giving, lending credibility to those folks. And then some screenshots of this Pasta guy on Parler, which is the right wing, you know,
the Pasta Parler.
So he's on this, you know, right wing social media, and he makes a post basically saying, we'll see you on January 6th. So he was in D.C. on January 6th. These people
instigating and encouraging others to be there.
Right. And, you know, while I don't think that what happened on January 6th was the worst thing that's ever happened in American history, it's also like anybody who was doing it, I'm like, I don't know.
No, not on their team. No.
No.
That's not all we want to storm the Capitol.
Right. So they're also like anti-vax, you know, have been very, very, very just kind of stoking all of that
skepticism. And all that has kind of crossover with QAnon shit. Like, it's all kind of in the same pond, right?
So this is what I'm saying, that they're trying to bridge that gap, and that's dangerous.
But not in a way that's like, let's educate these folks and help them see where their rage really should be directed and that Trump is not on their team. Like, again, you want to work with right-wingers, you want to help right-wingers understand that, you know, there's a 1% elite against the rest of us. Like, okay. But don't do it by fueling, flames of propaganda lies or, you know, neo-Nazi rhetoric or, you know, trying to say that COVID isn't real or anything like that. That is not the way to build alliances.
Right. And sometimes it's just like ignorance and stupidity. So, both like Jimmy Dore and the Convo Couch have platformed Boogaloo Boys. And
without, do we need to explain what that is? Let's just include a link to a story about it.
Okay. So Boogaloo Boys, to anybody who actually understands them, and that's what's frustrating. You're like trying to build alliances on the things we have in common, but you haven't done your research on who the fuck these people are, where they originated, what their strategy is, what their tactics are. And that's how they're getting you, you idiots. Like, they... The Boogaloo Boys kind of came out of the 4chan alt-right machine of, there's a Break Into Electric Boogaloo, an old movie, that's where it came from. But if you go back into, like, the old conversations that have been documented at the formation of this group, they were like, we're Civil War II Electric Boogaloo, Boogaloo Boys. Their goal is a civil war, specifically a race war. And so when you have Jimmy Dore and the Convo Couch going, oh, you support BLM because you show up to their actions armed, like, no, they are pretending to support it, and they're actually trying to escalate violence because they want a civil war. So it's just really frustrating to see the naivete of these people.
Especially when you have them on the show, it's like, maybe even there is a place for being like, okay, you say this, let's talk about it. But then be ready to grill the shit out of them and, you know, actually ask real questions and just instead of sort of like, we're going to take everything you say at face value. But not everybody has done their research on the inner belly ickiness of the right wing, like Shelley has.
Yeah. So that's why it's really frustrating when I'm being treated as like, oh, you hate Medicare for all. Like, no, I just
go to Facebook groups and happening. I know these fuckers.
Yeah, exactly.
For people who don't know, Shelley has a long history of being in like free speech spaces on the social media internet and getting a really good read on what these alt-right online organizers are kind of like up to and talking about and the angle that they're coming from. So
it's amazing. Yeah. Her ability to tolerate that for the sake of intel is like such a gift.
I don't know where it came from, but yeah, I've always just had a good stomach for it. Although I haven't been doing that in a while, but I learned enough. I did it for a few years. So yeah, I was in spaces where like, I never was like in 4chan, but there are basically what they do is they come up with their ideas there and then they unload them and so that they get disseminated. And I was in a lot of spaces that would be like the first place they would like, you know, so this is a little aside, but you know, like the free bleeding thing that happened a few years ago, and then there was actually a runner who like did it as a feminist, but it was a total invention of 4chan. They know how to get us. They know
free
how.
Free leader was to go around without wearing any tampons or pads or anything.
Yeah,
like that,
and just bleed out. And just bleeding because you're a woman, and you know, and like it, that was not the original.
Nobody really
4chan.
Actually is for that.
But there were a few people who did do it, which made feminists look ridiculous. So that's their goal, right? They're not stupid. Okay, so so back to Pasta and Fiorella, who are anti-mask, anti-vax, stop the steal adjacent. Fiorella will kind of play both sides a little bit, but Pasta is very much, you know. So they get announced as speakers, and everyone is like, so we're going to have anti-vaxxers at a healthcare event. This seems bad. And this is like 2 days before. And like, I was on, I think I was on the main March for Medicare for All Twitter page when they announced these speakers. And I just, it was like way down in a thread. And I just said, as someone who needs Medicare for All to survive the next decade, I deeply prefer to not have anti-vax cranks who clearly crave the approval of reactionaries at the forefront of this movement. It is a really bad look. I feel like, I just want to say, I think I should get partial credit in what happened after this. So Pasta replies. So he's the guy who actually, you know, and I didn't say his name. It was way down in a thread. So he was looking for somebody to fight. And he responds back to me and he says, so you want an authoritarian type takeover? Like, do you know what single payer is, sir? only Medicare for All that Big Pharma approves of. And you think you're progressive? You're a narcissist. You can't even respect someone else's opinion different than yours. Because CNN told you this vaccine works, you're pitching it as science? Wow.
Shelly, quit it. You're always parroting CNN.
God, I'm just so glad that somebody finally called you on the fact
thank you.
That you're
Jeez,
such
was becoming a
this is actually a planned intervention.
Dog.
So I retweet this. You know, I've got like 7,000 followers. So like it got a little traction and everybody was like, whoa, like he likes, like I baited. I didn't mean to bait him, but I baited him into saying like the dumbest possible shit that somebody could say before they're about to go speak at a fucking Medicare for All rally. Like,
you're so good on Twitter. You are a masturbator sometimes. You really are very good at getting people.
Sometimes. On occasion. So that, you know, that made the rounds. And then next thing we hear is from the I think it came directly from Pasta. I don't know that it was announced officially elsewhere.
Yeah, no, he just put it on his Twitter.
He just said, you know, these assholes at the march, they wanted me to take a COVID test and my body, my choice. And so I'm not doing this anymore.
Get the fuck out of here, bro. This is not going to work. That's not going to work.
The part that's like weird is it's like, how did he even get a speaking spot anyway? You know, like, as you said, it's like the end. They already have a full lineup. He doesn't add anything. What does he bring? Then it's like, is he even for Medicare for All? That's questionable.
No, he's not.
Arguably not. He says he is, right? So if they're naive and don't know, but I mean, like, then what he says subsequently is like, wait a minute, is Medicare for All a right? Or is that a big government conspiracy, or are we for it? Like, it can't be. What the hell are you talking about?
Right. It's a mess. And it's like, okay, I mean, if these people want to, like, support it on their show or whatever, like, that's one thing. But to fucking platform these cranks is a whole nother. So I was really pleased to see, you know, him, obviously, like, I think they stepped in and was like, hey, this is how we get him to, like, self-select out, is make him take a COVID test and show he's vaccinated. So Fiorella,
he didn't even have to show he was vaccinated. He just had to take a COVID test and wear a mask, which also is like, I mean, there are people who are not vaccinated who would never, you know, who are not that ridiculous. It's like, wait, does he even believe that COVID is real? Because people who don't believe in that COVID is dangerous are different than people who don't want to get vaccinated. There's an overlap, but there's also a lot of people who are not both, and anybody who's both is like full-blown, like,
yeah,
no
I
way
think
does
he's...
that person want to be anywhere near your microphone.
After doing research, too, he's, like, one of those, like, really, really over-the-top, like, health nut people, too. So I haven't seen any evidence either way on his, like, belief about COVID itself. But he does seem like somebody who's like, oh, COVID can't get me, you know.
If I eat enough kale, I'll fight it off.
So that happens. Fiorella, you know, makes a statement that she opposes the decision, but that she's still going to speak. So then the march happens, and Fiorella gets the mic. And she is going over time. And then she starts going on about Julian Assange. Uh-oh. So, and this is like this realm of the left, this is kind of their big thing, right? And everything goes back to that for them, and that is the crux, like that's it. And so she starts talking about that, and you see this woman trying to take the mic from her because her time was up.
Her time is up, and she's off topic.
She's off topic.
Normally, yep. Why you would take the mic from somebody?
That's grounds.
Organizing a solid march.
So that happens, and anyway, the march is over. And then a couple days later, the main account, this is a now deleted tweet, I tried to find if anyone had any screenshots of it, and I was unable to find that. But the National March for Medicare for All account makes a tweet saying, we have let go of a LA March organizer, I can't remember her name right now, but she's the one who took the mic.
Betty,
and then a hyphenated last name. She's the co-chair of Healthcare for All LA, which is the organization that's behind the single payer push in California. She's been working on this issue for a really long time. She didn't just like start thinking about it last summer, you know, and I think that she, you know, was probably the one behind PASTA getting taken out. So they make this tweet that they are announcing that they have kind of banned her for the way that she treated certain people. So, and that was...
That just
so,
sucks. That's just, yeah. Like, that is not... that's not how the story should end up.
Yeah. I mean, I, like...
And it was more than that. It was, like, a very big, like, public takedown. Like, they went into, like, way too much detail that would have been inappropriate, right. Like, in any circumstance.
It was very petty.
Like, it was, like, very crushing.
Like, why would you even air that to her?
You didn't have to.
Even if you do it, don't say anything.
Exactly.
That's really
weird. They did
not
have to mention it. So, what I think is that the national team was behind trying to get Fiorella and PASTA on, and then the local team was like, this is terrible. So, yeah. So it was just like, you know, when I tried to, after the Matthew Heimbach debacle, I was like, hopefully they've learned from this. Heimbachle. And then when that happened at the LA thing, I was just like, wow, this actually is just fundamentally terrible and sad. And it sucks because there were a lot of marches were on the ground. It was like good local coalitions, good people, good speakers. You know, like there were a lot of really, really good people who were involved in this. But there were a lot of really dangerous entryism issues that are going to keep happening.
Yeah, and it's like, how and why? Like, I don't, the naivete and the lack of experience, you know, it's like we've all fucked up things and been there and, you know, and so it's like, okay, there's got to be room for that to be something that happens and something that's dealt with.
No, but this felt very sabotaging.
But like, what's going on, really? Yeah, you know, like, why, when you look at the situation, why would you align with the crackpots that are obviously just looking for a platform to use this really important issue that, you know, we shouldn't allow anybody to use for notoriety purposes, personal notoriety purposes.
Before she started talking about Assange, like, was she talking about Medicare for All? Like, do they have a message that is in support of the march?
It was mostly like squad bashing, which, you know, like there's legitimacy to that for sure, but like, you know, she was definitely they're trying to turn everyone against. The one thing that was funny was she was like, we all gave our last dime to the squad. And then somebody went and looked up, you know, her political donations. She's not given more than $10. I think it was like $7 to Bernie Sanders and $3 to Tulsi Gabbard. And that is the extent of her political contribution.
Oh, so, people.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Well, to be clear, I have talked about how much money we have wasted on Bernie Sanders. No, and I personally didn't waste very much money myself.
But the way that she was talking, you would think that she's one of us and she did that too. But she was just trying to stoke that resentment and anger. So it was like, it didn't feel productive what she was saying, but it's not like I can say any of it in particular was wrong. It was just her brand, right? Like,
so is she a provocateur? Is she an infiltrator? Yeah. Is that, I mean, do we think?
I don't know.
I mean, obviously, we don't know, so we should say that. And
I think she's a grifter. You know? But I mean, that's how much I will say, because I think what happens is you can't say that there's like an intentional like agenda other than like, when I do this, I get more clicks. And so that's the problem, I think, in general. And we are a podcast, yes. But like podcasters being at the forefront of
a lot
of this stuff.
Okay, but just to be clear here, there is a history of the FBI and other police agencies in the United States doing a really good job of assessing such things.
I'm just not going to
bad jacket. And identifying key people who would be really good.
Yeah.
Because they're already stoking. You know, I mean, lots of times it's not people who are just come out of nowhere and are like, you know, paid police officers who then like get implanted and then work for several years to earn trust. It's people who are sort of marginal and want money and right. who can be bought off to be disruptors. So,
and
whether yeah, her or not, that is something that the FBI and the police know how to do.
I also want to say, and not to like totally mind fuck everybody listening right now, but like there is also a tactic that they use. No, but there is also another tactic that comes out of COINTELPRO where they like to stoke suspicion about people that are doing that. And so you can really get into a whole like mind fuck rabbit hole with that. But anyway, I'm not going to cop jacket anybody, but I will say that there are reasons to, you know, be side-eyeing these people for sure. especially Fiorella in particular. I also was listening to a podcast, Matt Binder, who is, you know, more aligned with kind of the DSA strategy, did a debate yesterday with them. I am on the convo couch, but I don't think it's worth anybody's time to listen to it, and I don't think that they should get clicks, so I'm not recommending it. I listened to it just to bone up before the show because we haven't, like, really been talking about this in a major way for some time, and I just wanted to, like, hear this discussion. But it was really funny because this pasta guy, who's, like, the one going around calling everybody shills and all of that, he voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Bro.
And now he's the true, you know, radical.
Pasta.
Like,
I
none
mean,
of
people
us did.
Can evolve, right? Let's say that. But at the same time,
I know,
time,
but it's just like, hilarious
what?
To be, to have the kind of aggression that he has when he came along a lot later than a lot of us into rejecting the Democratic
Party.
Well,
it's that born-again fervor, I suppose.
Right. Yeah, totally. And then Fiorella, by a lot of accounts, you know, Fiorella used to kind of match up with like the Bernie left. So either their brains got broken. I think a lot of people's brains have gotten broken from everything that's happened.
Sure,
but
shit. Feels
it is.
Like it.
It is interesting how they ended up just full on populist with nothing really else except for like anti-squad politics. Like that's basically their brand.
And I would is that even popular? I mean, what I don't even know. I know that we like that term is what we use for, you know, the Trump people or whatever, but it's like I that's how they would define themselves, and I would sort of question like, if you are the purveyor of extreme marginal positions, I'm not sure that you're really a populist, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's what he said he was. He was like, I'm not a leftist. I'm not, I am a populist, anti-imperialist.
He's
like
a fucking libertarian.
Then
you know?
He says,
that's really what
he says.
Here.
He says he wants, exactly he's, what that at sounds one point, like. At one point, he said he wanted a mixed economy that had a little bit of communism and a little bit of capitalism. Now, this is a political talk show host. It's like...
just the sprinkles.
But because they just come out so hard against the squad and just stoke that mistrust, like, that is enough for a lot of people. And it's really sad because they don't have an analysis beyond that. They don't have... they're not... there's no underpinning of, like, historical... nothing. They're just going for the outrage.
And whether you're right or wrong or, like, whatever, if your entire political shtick is bashing some young women, that's not good enough.
I mean, I have plenty to say about the squad. I have a lot of issues. You know, we all do, right? But, like, that's not a strategy either.
That's one thing.
Right.
But have a bigger analysis. Why? Why you are. You know, why we have to be strategically critical, right?
Well, and also, why take it personal every fucking time, too? Like, how we should not be allowing anybody who does that to be, like, spokespeople for the movement, because that's just not helpful. There's plenty of critique to have without saying, making conjectures about, like, you know, being bought off or, you know, reasons or whatever. It's like, the critique is fine. You don't have to be personally or
right, and that's the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah, so there's that, but then there's also, like, the irony that underpinning all of that, they, like, come off as just, like, anti- everybody in Congress, but then there's also, like, oh, we got a primary AOC. There's, like, still a belief in electoralism that underlies all of their anti-stuff, that it's, like, if you lead them back down their logic, that's still at the bottom. You still believe that it's effective to trash elected officials. That is a belief in electoralism, too, isn't it?
Like, totally.
Yeah.
So we wanted to talk about this, not to just sort of, like, because like you said, Shelley, it's not really something that's being talked about that much anymore. So, like, why are we hashing up something that maybe has been, you know, everyone's kind of moved on from? But what the state of the movement for Medicare for All is and what's going on is something that is ongoing. And two, I've seen and talked about in many circles, you know, had it brought up by others, the kind of just despair and frustration at how at where the left is at right now in terms of, like, strategy and ability to, you know, come up with a coherent strategy and or message and, you know, leadership. Where's our fucking leadership? So I think we wanted to talk about this as kind of an entry point into several things that are more than just, you know, what happened with this Medicare for All march. One, that's an ongoing thing. That group is continuing on and asking for support. And I think it would be really helpful, just to put it out there, if that group would be willing to explain themselves a little bit more for, you know, why they are aligning with these folks who are not helpful. And then two, you know, what's going on in this microcosm of, like, Medicare for All and the push for that is indicative of, you know, a larger issues that are at play for sure in, you know, the leftist ability to build a cohesive movement for power. So this would be a good one. Like, we kind of, like, got a little bit more controversial than normal. So if you've got feedback out there, if you have stuff to add to this, like, you know, go agitatedpodcast.com. is where you can talk to us and, you know, give us your sense of it. Also, if this was helpful or if it was, like, too insider baseball, that those are all things that I think we want to know going forward.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, a lot of this, you know, happens on Twitter, but, and you know, it was kind of sad, and I don't want to bash all the marches on the local level at all. That is, like, exactly what I don't want to do. And I do think it is kind of sad, you know, that it didn't get a lot of coverage. But I just see so many bad faith actors around that we need to watch out for. There was also a thing that happened where the only person, the only elected official that showed up to a march was Cori Bush. She went to the D.C. march.
Federal elected official.
Yeah, right. Yeah, sorry, on the federal level. So she went to the D.C. march and, you know, they... basically, like, some of these media figures just, like, confronted her and trashed her And
media
then, like,
figures. Wait a minute.
Well, these, you know, these constellation podcast of figures. Podcast people.
Just like, I guess that's, you know, media. It's just, you know,
just like trashed her and then trashed her for not tweeting about it. But, you know, we'll never know because it happened. But I'm sorry. It is not hard for me to understand why somebody, if they're paying attention to like what's going on in LA and all, like why they would be a little reticent to just like come out and align themselves with this like came out of nowhere group that has been making a ton of mistakes and doesn't really, you know, seem to have a very coherent plan other than to just like bash the people who, you know.
There was also an issue in Ohio where they listed at least one organization that hadn't signed off as an endorser, which, you know, I mean, that's, again, it's like, I can see how that mistake would be made entirely in good faith by accident, but that's a lot of things. And so,
but there was also some like some of their Slack conversations were leaked as well. And there were people ringing the bell. There were people going, are we vetting anybody? Are we vetting? And somebody was like, we don't have time for that. So it's just like this needs to be explored and kind of picked apart because there were points where these problems could have been avoided. And they just went like full steam ahead every step of the way and didn't apologize at any point for anything. So,
well, and also
Shelly is,
oh, you go ahead, Jessica.
I was just going to say, Shelly is available for hire if you're planning an event and need to vet your speakers.
I'm very good at this.
She works by the hour and it's expensive, but she's excellent.
I would do it.
For Medicare for All, it might not even be that expensive.
I need Medicare for All. I will be the vetter, the gatekeeper.
And before we wrap up, though, I mean, I want to like sort of fundamentally like emphasize that we believe that you're going to have to put our bodies on the line to get the demands mm-hmm. met that we need.
Absolutely.
Particularly Medicare for All, because no one in Congress is doing what they need to do to get this done.
Sure. Well, and also, you know, I think that it's worth saying and acknowledging that part of why all of this like kind of populist energy for Medicare for All and this, you know, the whole operation, the marches and then what they're going to continue on with it is happening because there is a leadership vacuum in terms mm-hmm. of creating a way for people who need Medicare for All, who are passionate about it, who are willing to work for it, to plug in a way that is disruptive. And we are at the stage now where disruption would make sense.
Yes.
You know, the demand is out there. The policy is out there. The studies that prove that it's actually cheaper and that it would, how many people?
Not only studies, like examples of so many countries.
Oh, right. Totally. Well, you know, but we've got all of it. We've got all of it. And so this is the point where when elected officials don't act, escalation is the appropriate next step to take. And the establishment mm-hmm. Medicare for All activist organizers are not really putting forward a strategy of how escalation should happen that will help move the bill forward. And so in the absence of that, people are stepping up and we see that some of those people don't have experience. Some of those people maybe don't have context and history. And then also maybe some of those people are exploitative and trying to take advantage, right? And so there is some responsibility that should fall at the feet of the Congress members who supposedly are there to champion Medicare for All for us, who are not showing leadership like they should. And then also these organizations who have a lot of money that they could be putting into, for example, marches all over the country. And for whatever reason, you know, they're just channeling us into call your congressperson. And that's really not an adequate tactic. Well, so people could, I mean, there is Medicare for All, you know, we maybe should look. I don't know what the name of it is, but we should look and see. But, you know, the National Alliance of folks who are working for Medicare for All, part of what we could do is join up with them and then push, you know, as volunteers and activists within the movement joining the establishment movement and pushing for more escalation in that way. I think that, you know, we've talked on the show about the strategies at the state level, and unfortunately the Democratic Party at the state level is blocking that, but that would
Washington
be another
might
place.
Be in a better shape than California. Mm-hmm. So if you're in Washington, I think the campaign is called Whole Washington. And they were, you know, I think pretty aligned with the March for Medicare for All, but they also have been like doing the real work for a long time and are doing actual political organizing at the same time. So I think that's an example of kind of keeping a foot in both.
And even if we don't live in a state, if any state were to successfully pass a Medicare for All bill, that would be huge for everywhere yeah. else. And so yep. whenever there is anybody who is close, those of us who are not residents of that place should still support it financially and or, you know, getting everyone we know who's in that state to get involved.
Yeah, yeah. And it looks like the NNU, the National Nurses United website for this is Medicare4all.org. Is that what you
so
were
that
thinking
would,
of?
Yeah, so that would be where to plug in if you wanted to, you know, join the folks who have been working on this for many, many, many years, who have done all those studies, who have written the policy at the national level. But we do need, you know, to push them to, yeah. again, it's like they're the inside strategy, but there is no outside strategy. And you can do that in a way that is like collaborative and, you know, somewhat in tandem, but by creating this vacuum. And saying, you know, no, we all just, you know, we're working with Pramila Jayapal and that's it. It's like, that's not doing anything right now.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Pushing, you know, the NNU and other groups that have been, you know, I think that they wouldn't disagree.
Right.
They're just not, that's not where they are, that they just have gotten sucked into continuing to organize in a certain way.
That's so normal in a movement mm-hmm. trajectory, right? So right. recognizing that and saying like, okay, outside pressure is maybe what would you know, push, because when you're in the middle of it, you don't necessarily, you're just not as in a good position to be able to see when these right. opportunities of escalation might be. That does kind of,
and it's not going to happen by screaming at them and calling them establishment shills, right? Like no. that's yeah.
Well, thanks, Shelley, for running through all this. Yeah.
Yeah. And let us know what you think. And I guess that's
a wrap.
That's our show.
Thanks for tuning
goodbye!
In. All right. Thank you for tuning in. You can sign up for our email list so you can get a notification whenever a new episode drops. Sign up to get notified at agitatedpodcast.com. You can also leave us your feedback under the Contact Us section of the website.
Don't forget, we've got stickers. If you'd like one, drop us a line with your address through any of our social media channels or the website. And speaking of social media, we'd love to connect with you there. You can find us at Agitated Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
Please don't forget to subscribe and rate us 5 stars on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you tune into podcasts. And if you would, leave a positive review on iTunes. It really helps the algorithm bump our podcast and new people find us on our show.
And please share us with your friends. Podcasts like ours grow through word of mouth. So thank you for your support. And a big thanks to Jason and Radical Guide for helping us produce this show, and Alfonso for helping us with promotion. See you next time. The pain will make you cry.